Good evening. We have some new faces tonight. Welcome. How did you hear about us?
Yelp.
Oh, how did we meet on Yelp?
I gave us 5 stars.
Great. And you?
Grace.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, she's my friend.
Yeah. I see. Well, welcome, everyone.
They're from Modesto.
Wow. Oh, from the Modesto group. Mm-hmm. Not from Empty Nest.
Well, yes. Sort of.
It's a piece of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's technically the leader of that song.
But she's not there very often anymore. Yeah. Yeah, but she has good students who come too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Azo and Andy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I met you at the women's retreat last year.
Oh, that's why you look familiar.
Yeah, I have longer hair. And it was more blonde.
That might explain it. Let's do introductions around. We won't remember the names, but.
Okay. Ellie.
Britt.
Jeffrey.
Marie.
Dawn.
Samia.
Ron.
Kat.
Jennifer.
Wendy.
Scott.
Three, two.
So, Scott and Eileen, have you sat Zazen before?
Not really, no. We're kind of new to all this. We read a lot of books, and I meditate at home, but never really like this. So it was all kind of new to us.
Yes, I can imagine. It must seem a little different.
Well, the Yelp review had a lot of stuff in there, so I was prepared a little bit.
I have to read this thing. Well, I've been thinking that... soon we should have an early part of this meeting so that people who have not much experience can come early and get some instruction, because it's hard to just plunge right into the group, although it's pretty easy. You're not required to do anything except sit and watch a wall. but even so, I think it helps to get instruction and get some sort of sense of how to go. So stay tuned. But in the meantime, you know, if you can manage it, you're welcome to come back.
Okay.
So we're studying the Lankavatara Sutra, which is a very ancient thing. Sutra put together around the turn, a little after the turn of the millennium, the millennium before last. It's a discussion between a student and Buddha. Endless questions are asked and endless questions are answered. It addresses our way of mind, our view, in terms of how we see. Our view, in the language that they use here, is about how we project. We actually project everything. We project a self. We project other selves. We don't just experience what happens, but then we project a judgment and an idea, some kind of philosophy or a theory. We have lots and lots of ways of thinking about what we experience. And this is pointing to, not to say that we should not do that, but that is an illusion. If you want to know how things are, you have to stop that kind of judgmental thought and just experience things as they are, without projecting onto them your own ideas of whether it's a good or a thing or a bad thing, or you like it or you don't like it, or all of the things that we do that make our life very complicated and often very painful. In the chapters today, we're on page 118, is that an 8? No, that's a 6. He's asking about words. And this is especially interesting to me at the moment because I'm home from Taos, New Mexico, where I took a 5-day writing workshop. And the whole general tone of it was about this very subject, about how words can be journalistic words, pointing to some information, some way to inform ourselves about something that's happening in the world, but that there's another kind of words, use of words, that come from a different place, that actually arise from what they said in the conference was the unconscious. I would say it's from even deeper than the unconscious, but certainly it comes from a place we don't know. And if we allow them to come, we are invariably surprised because so much is in us that we don't know. And when we allow those words to arise, then they say things that we're not expecting. They say our truth, our real truth, which sometimes is, it's like sitting zazen. We come to the sit and let ourselves just be where we are and try to be present. But it's amazing how many things go through our heads, how many sort of revelations arise if we sit for a long time. We're surprised by what appears to be inside us. So in terms of this chapter, Buddha says words, object words, like words for milk or ice cream, arise from attachment to the projection of forms and characteristics. So, of course, we project on ice cream really, really well. And dream words arise from recollecting previously experienced realms that upon waking are found to be non-existent. Words for attachment to mistaken projections arise from recollecting previous acts of, they say, hostility. And the note is that it's based on ego consciousness, that in these psychological terms, anything that's based on the ego is automatically hostile, basically hostile. That there's the self, and then there's everybody else, and the self protects itself, sets up a barrier of some kind. So those are the four kinds of word projection. And then he says there are he asks whether the words and projections are separate or not separate. Is the word for ice cream the same as ice cream? Are they the same or are they different? And the Buddha replies, words and projections are neither separate nor not separate, because one is the cause of the other. If words and projections were separate, projections could not be their cause. And if they were not separate, words could not express their meaning. But they do. Hence, they are not separate and not separate. it's a challenge to manage these words, but the negative and the not negative are both trying to express something that's inexpressible. And that's basically the whole essence of it, that there is all of this that we can say or try to say, even though the word for book or the word for sky is arbitrary. In other languages, there are other words for those things. But when we allow our mind to be quiet enough, to be present enough, to not depend on words, but to let what my teacher used to say, where words come from, just to let the words arise from where they come from. We think we know we're saying what we're saying. We think we know we're talking when we're talking, but actually, we don't know what we're going to say until we say it. It comes. And if we're well-tuned, it comes in a deeply relevant way, in a connected way, in a way that is aligned with the way things work in this world. So then Mahamati asked the Buddha, Bhagavan, are words ultimate truth, or what they express ultimate truth? And the Buddha replied, Mahamati, words are not ultimate truth, nor is what they express ultimate truth. Ultimate truth is what Buddhas delight in, and what words lead to is ultimate truth, but words are not ultimate truth. So that's that old Zen expression of pointing to the moon. You know, the words are the finger pointing, but you have to experience the moon yourself. And if you look in the right direction, it's right there. Right here, actually. It's nowhere else. Ultimate truth is what is attained by the personal realization of Buddha knowledge. So it isn't what comes from books, although books are the finger pointing. But the real experience happens in your own mind-body. And so when we sit, we're offering our mind-body to the present moment and to this unspeakable truth that is our life. Ultimate truth, he said, it is not a realm known by means of projection of words. So the projection of words doesn't express ultimate truth. Words arise and cease and shift with their occurrence depending on changing causes and conditions. What depends on changing causes and conditions for its occurrence does not express ultimate truth. Because of the non-existence of their own characteristics or of those of something else, words do not express ultimate truth. They can't possibly. Because any characteristics of an external existence does not exist except as a perception of one's own mind. So this is it. Whatever we see out there, there really isn't an out there. And there really isn't an in here. But we project, our minds project out there, and that's what we name, what we give names to and identify which also means pointing to. The projection of words does not express ultimate truth, so you should avoid the projection of words. He says, okay. So then he gets into the question of differences. What about sameness and difference, both and neither, existence, non-existence, neither existence nor non-existence, permanence and impermanence? All these different ways that we try to describe and characterize our experience. And in some way take it in, because words are the way that we not only express, but know what we're thinking. One wonderful practice is just to sit down and start writing and see what happens. And a lot of people don't want to do this because we don't know what's going to come up if you just keep on writing. And things do come. So it's a good thing to do. It's like sitting. It brings you into focus in a new way. So he goes on to say that these differences, these opposites, are all about projection anyway. And if we want to accord with the truth of ultimate reality, so he's asking, how do we and other bodhisattvas avoid views of the individual or shared characteristics of an imagined reality and quickly attain unexcelled perfect enlightenment and enable other beings to achieve complete happiness and contentment? Now that's the whole point of practice, of course. Enlightenment, but not enlightenment so I can be a much better person and shine around in the world, but it's to exactly enable other beings to achieve complete happiness and contentment and enlightenment. It's a generous and compassionate practice, not one for our own aggrandizement. In fact, it's a very humbling practice. We have to step down in order to do this kind of work. And the Buddha gets all excited and he says, "It's excellent, Mahamati, excellent that you're able to ask me about the meaning of such things for the happiness of the many, for the welfare of the many out of compassion for all gods and humans." He said, "Listen carefully now and I'll clarify and explain this for you." So, he says, "Foolish people cling to internal and external existence due to the habit energy of their attachments to projections of the self-existence of sameness or difference, both or neither, etc., etc., unaware that those things are nothing but their own mind." It's like when deer are oppressed by thirst and they see a shimmering mirage and think it's water and rush toward it, unaware it isn't water. Foolish people are infected by the habit energy of beginningless projections and fabrications and are inflamed by the fires of greed, anger, and delusion. Delighting in worlds of form and beholding their origination, duration, and cessation, and clinging to external and internal existence, they fall prey to grasping and imagining conceptions of their sameness or difference or both or neither, etc., or for their permanence or impermanence. So these are all sort of big questions that we often ask, you know, does the self continue? are we the same as everybody else? Are we different? How are we different? And Buddha says, it's all a misunderstanding. He said, and then he gives a number of examples, but he calls those, all of them, their beginningless attachment to fictions, and are thus unable to see them as nothing but perceptions of their own minds. So our practice is to continually try to develop a close, intimate relationship with our mind, to see how it's working, to know oneself and one's world, not in terms of our conditioning, the things that we are given. We're given our language, our name, our world as we're born, and then we modestly and sometimes happily take it all in, and then begin to suspect that it's not the way it sounds. It's not that things are as solid as they look. It's not that things are everlasting as they look. The way that we see things, if we're not clear, and if we see it from the sense of this isolated self, then we get mixed up. So Buddha is pointing out our attachment to these things. It's not just that we have that kind of sense of distinguishing, but that we're attached to it. We want to say, I like this, or that's the best, or that's the worst, or that shouldn't happen. I talked to an old friend, an old Dharma friend, Martin Mosco, today, and he called to see how I was doing, and I told him how I was doing, and he said he was doing the same, which is falling apart. We had such a good laugh about it. And I thought later, you know, we didn't say, oh, why me, or what a terrible thing, or any of that. It was just, and it wasn't a joke. I mean, we both were complaining about it. It was not very fun. But it's just the way it is. And in that sense, it's so interesting. It's so, because we don't have to characterize it as one way or the other. You know, as a good thing or a bad thing or a, you know, and none of that. That's all extra. The thing itself is so interesting. And out of that comes our deepest knowledge. If we're willing to, as Kogan always said, to allow what's happening to happen, to what's being to be. And that's what Buddha is pointing to here. Don't have to get attached to our own ideas about things. We can enjoy our ideas and develop them and try them out, test them, change them. But if we get stuck with them, we're in a not so pleasant a place, because life goes on. So there are just a few minutes to talk a little bit. Questions? Oops. Had a lot of practice.
So, words are social conventions that we use to communicate with other people. And it's been occurring to me as I've been reading the sutra that it's very much about what goes on in the mind from a individual perspective, and not very much about what goes on sort of mind to mind, if you will. Or, you know, it's easy to get caught as thinking about just what's going on in your own mind, but not when you interact socially.
With relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if the sutra addresses
that. That's not the issue in the sutra. It's a very early Zen work, and so although it does talk about the reason for enlightenment is to make others happy, it doesn't go into the whole subject of menju, the face-to-face relationship that happens further on in history. These are real new ideas then, and then on these ideas were built other ways of trying to explain the unexplainable experience that we have in our life, in our sitting.
So when they're talking about words, it's really more about sort of naming things and solidifying them in your own mind, as opposed to using them for conventional or shared truth.
Yes. Yeah, it's sort of how we use words to explain.
But it's also co-constructed.
Of course, because somebody tells us what the words are in the first place.
Both at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, there's more than... There is more.
It reminds me of this little kid that comes to this coffee house every morning. She's probably about a year and a half, and she just waltzes in and has her own language. You would think that she knows exactly what she's saying.
She does.
So I tell her, Mom, do you know what she's saying? She says, not a word. But she always walks around the house and wherever, just totally convinced.
Well, you know, I have two brothers. 2 years apart, and when the second brother was born, when he was about a year and a half, he started talking like that, and the older brother knew what he was saying.
Wow.
He understood it, but we never understood it. I was five by then, so that was, you know. Yeah, it's
very nice to see. I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, it's great. My friend Trout used to take kids on hikes up in a hidden villa and have them pick up a leaf or something and give it a new name just for their own self. You know, we can all do that. We can call anything, anything. And it kind of loosens everything up if we do that. You know, it sort of breaks the iconography in our mind that thinks that words are real and everything has to be just like this. But if you start messing around with it, you begin to feel like, oh, we're free. We don't have to be nailed down to all this. It's just a convention. Yes?
I'm part of this group of people, and there's an actor in Britain called Benedict Cumberbatch. He was recently in Star Trek. But everybody messes up his name so often that... Nobody really, everybody's always been getting it wrong. So all the people who know who he is has gotten so used to seeing Benedict Cumberbatch spelt a million different ways that whenever somebody misspells it, they just go, yep, know who you're talking about. They don't even catch the misspellings. We're so used to, like, the idea of who he is.
Yes.
Than needing to know his name anymore.
That's right. Then that just becomes the name. Yeah. Yeah, and names are morphing all the time, constantly. Drives some people crazy. In my day, it wasn't like that. of course not. Well, it's 8 o'clock.